maybe the question arises as to why there is so much interest on this topic in the United States. You know, why is it that, you know, all of a sudden SIGDAR 4 popped up? And I guess maybe you can address the issue of the fact that SIGDAR 4 is actually very much connected to with Zionist groups in the United States. And, you know, the interest of these groups is to crowd out solidarity with Palestinians, for example, and to crowd out the calls for the divestment. So I was wondering if you could address that angle of why the interest in SIGDAR 4 in the United States.
Did everybody hear that? Okay, the question to summarize it was, is there a connection between Save Darfur and various kinds of pro-Israeli mobilization and politics in the United States? First question. Will you stand up and try to make sure everybody can hear you?
I basically ran the student movement on Darfur in this country, and I did a lot of talks to people of many different ages. We were calling for, well, the first thing is that that movement had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with Zionism or Israel in the UK or Iraq, the first thing. The organization that started this movement in Protect Darfur campaign in 2005, March, was Aegis Trust, and that had absolutely nothing to do with Israel or Zionism.
No. Let him finish, and then.
Yeah, we were calling for UNAMID, or a UN force, to take over the African Union's mandate on the basis that African Union was doing a fantastic job, but it was under-resourced. Its troops weren't being paid, and it simply didn't have the resources to do the job that was on its mandate. And so, yeah, we lobbied for the UNAMID. I just wanted to know what was so wrong with, what do you believe is so wrong with UNAMID?
Okay, fine, that's your question. Try to remember, comrades, that we want to hear Mahmoud on Mahmoud's responses to some of these issues. Yeah. Stand up, please, and speak up.
Dr. Mamdani, I actually agree with most of your conclusions and your logic. I just want to be a little bit of a devil's advocate and probe you a little bit further on the issue of humanitarian intervention in general. There are two competing ideologies at the moment in the world. One is that of state sovereignty, and the other is humanitarian intervention. The fad of the 90s was that the era of state sovereignty is over, and there have to be exceptions under circumstances, for example, Darfur. Leaving Darfur aside as one example of that, in general, do you oppose the principle of humanitarian intervention, or would you qualify it in some way?
I'll take one more question. One more for the moment, and then Mahmoud will respond. Yeah.
Perhaps you've already
if you can speak, stand up and speak up.
Perhaps you've already been asked this question, given that you've been around so many different forums. But it was sort of the parallels. You called it a new mobilization. But when you were talking about Darfur, I was immediately thinking about Kosovo, actually, and some of the same sort of moralistic, you know, black and white sort of trajectories that were posed there. There was roughly 70,000 Romani people that were ethnically cleansed in Kosovo, apart from the Albanians who were under threat. A lot of people, the media just didn't even address that issue. And these people are now in Serbia today, living in refugee camps and all over. I just wanted to ask you, are there not a lot of parallels in some respects with the Kosovo intervention, which was also a humanitarian intervention, which was also promoted by the Human Rights Watch, likes of Arya Nair, etc.?
Okay, yeah, I've got a lot. Save Darfur began as an interfaith coalition of religious groups, mostly right-wing Christian evangelical and Jewish Zionist. In the first rallies in New York City and Washington, D.C., Save Darfur prepared what they call faith packets. Christian faith packets, Jewish faith packet, and Muslim faith packet. So they would ask you your identity and give you the appropriate faith packet. The Christian faith packet said that the Lord had empowered Christians to lead. The Jewish faith packet said that the Lord had given Jews the sensibility to identify genocide wherever it occurred. And the Muslim faith packet said that the Lord has placed you in a context where you are best placed to identify perpetrators in your midst. Christians were to be drivers, Jews were to be navigators, and Muslims were to be informers. That was the division of labor. Well, there were many tendencies in Save Darfur, as it grew especially. And there were those who had come out of the South Sudan campaign, both religious and secular, with solidarity links with the SPLA. They assumed that Darfur was just another version of South Sudan. But Darfur wasn't. It wasn't, because whereas in South Sudan the conflict had begun from the very outset as an insurgency against the central government, in Darfur it had begun as a civil war. Which is why in Darfur there was not one movement like the SPLA, but fragmented movements. Which is why in Darfur there was not a leader like John Garang. There was another group which came whose sensibilities were informed by the Rwandan genocide. This was, after all, the 10th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. This group argued that there comes a time when you must not stop to ask why a conflict is happening. You must simply act. Because by the time we found out who was a Hutu and who was a Tutsi in Rwanda and why the Hutu were killing the Tutsi were dead. So when is this time? This time is the time of genocide. And how do you know it's the time of genocide? You know it because you're told. Who tells you? Your leaders tell you. This splitting between knowing and acting, between the lemmings on the ground acting and the leadership knowing, became the major rationalization for the depoliticization and decontextualization of Darfur. It's as if you had a patient in ICU and you told the doctor, hey, there's no time to diagnose, just prescribe. Or if you went a step further and said, you know what, I don't think you should prescribe, I think those most outraged should prescribe. There is a Zionist connection. The best piece I've seen on it is in the Jerusalem Post. I cite it. But I just cite it. I don't even cite most of what it says. I didn't want to follow that path. Because I knew if I followed that path, I would open myself up to a debate, which I didn't want to be the debate on Darfur. I thought it would be a disservice to the question of Darfur and to the scholarship I was trying to undertake to make this into a central issue. And I thought there was more to Save Darfur than simply another Zionist front. There was something new it was bringing which needed to be pointed out. The UN force, the African Union, ask yourself, why was the African Union under-resourced? In the agreement for African Union soldiers to go in, there was an agreement with Western countries. They would provide the resources. Africa would provide the bodies on the ground. The US pledged $50 million. It didn't give a cent, not one cent. The Canadians promised helicopters and pilots. They hired civilian helicopters from Eastern Europe and civilian pilots. And civilian pilots had the right not to fly into conflict zones. The European Union pledged to pay the salary of the African soldiers. The European Union announced after 4 months that they had evidence of corruption amongst the bureaucrats in Addis Ababa, so that henceforth they would release salaries only for a quarter. And it is only after they received proper accountability that they would release salaries for the next quarter. I've never seen a war where soldiers were not paid because bureaucrats were corrupt. No war would continue, because war is the ideal time for corruption. We all know that. The European Union stopped paying African Union soldiers. For 8 months they were not paid. How do you expect soldiers in a foreign country to survive? There was every kind of corruption, and the media reveled in reporting on this corruption. There was a systematic, deliberate attempt to discredit the African Union. As I said, not because they wanted other soldiers there. Well, they did, but that was not the main reason. The main reason was they wanted the command shifted. Because the difference between the African Union and the UN was that the UN had no understanding that this conflict could only be solved politically. And the African Union was resolved that the only resolution could be political. That was the difference. The devil's advocate. Where is the devil? Humanitarian intervention. You know, take any conflict in Africa over the last, since independence, I would say. Or take any humanitarian emergency, whether it is the result of drought and famine or internal conflict. Whether it's Ethiopia, Angola, Congo, Darfur, in every case, without exception, there has been a conflict between the large international NGOs and the government of the day. The conflict is about who is sovereign. It's not a conflict between humanitarian intervention and state sovereignty. It is whether the humanitarian NGOs are sovereign or the state is sovereign. That's the conflict. Who sets the rules? Who has the right to supervise whom? I have not heard anybody demand in any emergency in any Western country that the international NGOs set their own rules. The international NGOs claim that because they represent the victims, they have the moral standing to set the rules themselves. Why should they? They're not the victims. What they're claiming is representation. The government of the day claims representation not of victims, but of citizens. These are two different narratives. The narrative of victim and ward who needs to be rescued is not a narrative that can offer a future to the peoples of Africa or any other people. It is a narrative into a sinking dependence. I'm not trying to defend the government, but I'm trying to say, let's be clear about what's at stake. Let's not just accept this narrative and its claim to a moral standing. Its claim that it cannot be questioned, because holier than thou. Don't, because this is politics, leave it out. This is a rescue operation. Let's look at the politics of that rescue operation. That's what I'm saying. Is there an exceptional case? Yes, there may be an exceptional case. I don't deny that.
In other words, I am perfectly willing to accept that there may be a case where an external intervention may be necessary. But my view is that in that case, the intervention has to be preferably from the region, not from the big powers. Not from individual countries in the region like Uganda and Rwanda and Congo or Ethiopia and Somalia, but from a regional organization like the African Union in Darfur. Why? For two simple reasons. One, your neighbors can't run away. They can't be like the US in Afghanistan, here today, gone tomorrow. They have to live with the consequences of their intervention. Two, they are your peers. They are more likely to be able to put themselves in your own shoes. Not to exceptionalize the problem and demonize it. I'm afraid I don't know that much about Kosovo. Limitation. But, you know, part of the reason I did this was that others could do write about other places. So.
There's a Tarek Ali edited book called Masters of the Universe, the Balkan States.
Thanks for that information. I think, yes, Johan was up before and you're behind, yeah?
You ended your talk almost by this phrase, a political reform versus criminal trials. I think there is a problem which has got to be solved. It's this. It is a fact that after the conflict ends, people have to live together. But if that is the case, then the perpetrators can be reasonably sure that after the violence, etc., is over, there will always be a higher purpose, and a higher purpose will actually be the necessity to live together. And therefore, chances are that they could say that we will get away with it because a higher purpose will intervene and a political solution will be negotiated, forced, discussed, rather than criminal trials. So the chances are that we won't be punished. I mean, this is what in a sense happens in the case of Steve Biko, that the higher purpose enables the perpetrators to get off scot-free, or at least with very little punishment.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with much of your critique of what's been happening in the Save Darfur campaign. My question is really about what to do about the government of Sudan. Because the obvious examples that you've given, South Africa, Sierra Leone, in both those cases there was regime change. Mozambique, the main, if you want to apportion blame, the main perpetrators were seen as the NAMO rather than the government. So how are we going to get to a situation where there's political resolution with the government of Sudan? I know you spent a lot of time in Sudan in the course of researching this, but what is your reading of the potentiality of that? In relation to these other places where that has happened, so I think that's my main question.
Thank you. Yes, and then you.
Yes.
Can you stand up and
yes,
so everyone can hear you?
I wonder if you could elaborate in a little bit more detail whether you see a relation between the depoliticization of the Sudan and the U.S. war on terror.
And if you can sort of speak to the majority, yeah.
My question is more related to Somalia, and I wanted to tie it back to your observation of shoddy media reporting and the role of intellectuals or educators. I have a lot of Somali friends who identify the Somali privacy with the problems of illegal fishing that's happening off the Somali coast, caused by a lot of Western countries. But when I talk to Western intellectuals working in Somalia, they brush aside the fact that the two problems are connected. And I have a feeling that there might be a problem of Western intellectuals and Western media reporting on problems that are very inaccessible to people who are not from that region. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
four questions.
Yeah. I know that by standing here, I accept to answer questions, but not on everything. I can't answer the question in Somali. I mean, at least I wouldn't want to take advantage of this position. If we were talking one-to-one, I could say something, but, you know, I don't have anything which should give me this privileged position to answer
just
about Somali.
Yeah,
no, maybe. But, look, criminal trials. I don't want to deny that there's a price here, and it's exactly what you stated, which is that the criminals will go scot-free. Okay. The political reasoning is you can't criminalize the opposition if you want to treat them as political adversaries. This is what the British had to learn in the IRA case. They had to decriminalize the IRA in order to create the public opinion for talking to them. Look at the lesson of Rwanda. There were negotiations at Arusha. They had criminalized not only the Interahamwe, but the political wing, the Hutu power fellows. So they left them out of the negotiations. The result was that the Hutu power fellows felt no compulsion, moral or political, to defend the outcome of the negotiations. Neither did the RPF, but for another reason, it didn't want to share power. The negotiations fell apart. The dynamic led us to the genocide. Same thing in Darfur. You have had a demonization of the Janjaweed. The civil war of 87-89 was fought by two sides, tribal militias on both sides. The tribal militias on one side became rebel movements in 2001. Sociologically, they were the same, in the sense that they still drew their recruits from the same tribal groups. But ideologically, their perspective had expanded because of alliances they had built. One side had allied with the SPLA, the other side had allied with the Hassan Turabi Islamists in Khartoum. They become rebel movements. Their adversaries remained tribal militias, out of which came the Janjaweed. The Janjaweed were demonized so much so that in the negotiations that followed in Abuja, only one side in the civil war participated in the negotiation. The other side was excluded as Janjaweed. Not only that, if you go to Darfur today and you go to the international NGO-run camps, you are unlikely to find, in most camps you will find, that they will not admit an Arab Darfuri as a victim. In most camps you will find that the local employees in that camp do not include Arab Darfuris, because to be an Arab Darfuri you are presumed to be a perpetrator. There's a problem. There is a real problem of demonization. Now that's what's shared with the war on terror. The depoliticization and the demonization go hand in hand. You rule somebody out of humanity, and you rule them out of the political process. The same thing is happening in the Middle East. Hamas, Hezbollah. Right? I mean, if there are real conflicts, then include those with whom there is a conflict in the political process, if you're interested in finding a political solution to the conflict. If you're not, then say that you're interested only in a military solution. What to do about the
government in Sudan?
What to do about the government of Sudan? I mean, is it for me to say what to do about the Jordanians? I'll give you my thoughts on that one. I don't know, was how much of a regime change? In Mozambique, Renamo could come to power. Many thought in the last election Renamo might come to power. You know, it could come to power through the ballot. Let's take tougher questions. Kenya. Zimbabwe. Tougher questions. Right? Because, look, what you're getting in these conflicts is that this is not, we're not simply getting conflicts which are dividing, pitting factions in the political class, one against the other. We're getting conflicts which are dividing society. Right? The conflict in Zimbabwe is about one land and the other civil freedoms, particularly in the cities. Society is divided down the middle. Look at Kenya, same thing. Rift Valley, land question. There was a rigged election in Zimbabwe. And there was a rigged election in Kenya. The opposition in Zimbabwe claimed the rigging was 3-4%. The opposition in Kenya claimed the rigging was 10-11%. The number of deaths in Kenya were more than the number of deaths in Zimbabwe. In Kenya, the West did everything it could to force the opposition to join the coalition. In Zimbabwe, they did everything they could to force the opposition not to join the coalition. The only reason the credit for the coalition government in Zimbabwe has to go to SADC, in spite of the West. The West did everything it could to get South Africa to shut off the supply of electricity, subsidized electricity to Zimbabwe. There would have been a catastrophe if that had happened, and the South Africans refused. I believe they were right to refuse. And I believe that wisdom came from simply being neighbors. Simply being neighbors. That they'd have to pay the cost. So, why should regime change be the option? I mean, Sudan has been going through, look, the reverse side, the flip side of the civil wars in Sudan. There was a political reform in South Sudan. There was a political reform. There could be a political reform in Darfur. Why can't we think of political reform? Why can't we think of a disaggregating of forces, right, so that new kinds of constellations emerge alongside and as a consequence of the reform? Why just think of regime? I mean, what's this? Regime change. Where did the language come from? Not from SOAS. I mean, which orbit are we in without recognizing how we name the world in which we live and where we are getting those names from? I have lots of, you know, lots of my friends who are in the opposition parties in the region. I come from Uganda. And I find most of them are just hoping for a Western intervention. Anytime something happens, they run to the embassies to say, hey, donors, please stop the aid. Come on. You know, I mean, I don't deny at all that the problems political activists face in these contexts are very difficult. The governments are ruthless. They are determined to hang on to power, no matter what the cost. And the oppositions have apparently run out of imagination. But I don't know where an external intervention has solved the problem. So we've got a big problem on our hands. If we're not equal to it, maybe somebody else will.
Is that your question? Yeah? You're next.
Yep. This person was next, and I'll come to you and then you, okay? Can you speak up, please?
2 points. First one on the demonization of the so-called Arabs and Darfur. I agree that this is a problem, but it might actually be a consequence of the Arab Islamist supremacy movement that took hold throughout the 90s in Darfur, and of the extreme racism that was exposed there. And I think that needs to be looked at as background context. And also, I don't think that one can see the Darfur conflict only as a local conflict, because there are certain patterns throughout the history of Sudan, especially over the last 20 years, where marginalized groups made demand, and the government then put them down with the help of local militia. That not only happened in Darfur, but that also happened in the South Nuba Mountains and elsewhere. And second point is on the question of accountability. I just wonder, is impunity not one of the key factors, especially in Sudan, that perpetuates the conflict, and that has also helped to weaken the political opposition to such a point that they needed to seek help elsewhere? And also when it comes to the victims of the conflict, I mean, maybe it is because they don't even have the opportunity to speak out in Sudan itself. So, I mean, what are you going to say to the Sudanese human rights activists, who I know you've been in touch with as well, and who see accountability as one of the key means to bringing about fundamental long-term changes to the country?
Thank you.
I am wondering whether one would be very wrong to suggest that your emphasis in the hell of the expansion of the desert downward was the prime move of the conflict in the Sudan. One would think that that is actual oversimplification of the issue. So as the rest of the country. Because has it been a question of the nomads moving down and getting the lands of the people in the food? I suppose an easier solution would have been found in terms of coexistence and sharing of the resources that were there. Had they not had the support, I assume, and a mental link, of the part that you are and still are encountering, perhaps the conflict would have been so extensive as they're supposed to be. And the same line of witness and analysis comes down to the issue of comparing the Tanzanians with the Hutu power in Rwanda. The Hutu power in Rwanda were nothing other than the proponents of their country, idolatry. And that was certainly the center of activity that prepared the country to be at this stage. The Tanzanians cannot be compared to the power. They can be simply compared to the Egyptians there in Iran itself. Had they not had the firepower from the north, the government, the aeroplane is bombing, the military coming to their aid, I do not think that the conflict is not going to fight as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Someone here?
Just a quick one, which is the first one from the earlier comment that you made about the dynamics of the conflict. What role at all, if at all, has oil played in the conflict? And perhaps you can comment about the Darfur campaigns and a discussion about China.
Oil. Okay, we've got oil in China in case this wasn't getting big enough. Mahmoud's going to handle it.
Well, three excellent questions, I must say. Okay, let me begin with the demonization of the Arabs. I think I have no doubt there's an element of truth in what you're saying, which is that certain kinds of demonizations are easier to carry out than other kinds because they resonate. with experiences of people. What demonization does is it doesn't, it resonates with an experience, but then it twists it to a purpose. In writing this book, I was aware that the Save Darfur characterization of the conflict in Darfur as between Arabs and Africans, or sometimes light-skinned Arabs, dark-skinned Africans. Undergirding this was a theory of history, which was that Sudan is a country where native tribes, African, are dominated by settlers who came in, cohabitated with, lived with locals, produced a mix, Arab, and the problem is Arab supremacy in Darfur, as in Khartoum. So almost half of this book is an exploration into that. And very briefly, what I found, there is a history, the dominant historiography of Sudan is exactly this. It was on the basis of this historiography and its assumptions that the census that the British conducted in Sudan was created. The categories in the census were created. Race. Arabs were a race. But I found also an alternate narrative. I found this amongst two kinds of scholars. First were the historians who came out of the anti-war movement of the 60s and 70s, historians and anthropologists. People like Jay Spaulding, who wrote the history of Sinai. People like Wendy James, that came at Oxford. People like Cunnison, who wrote on the Baggara. Or folklorists, Sudanese folklorists. Abdullah Ibrahim, Abdullah Ali Ibrahim. And basically what I found in these narratives, although nobody had put them together, there was no meta-history, but they all pointed to an alternative history, which was this, that actually the immigration of Arabs from outside was a very minor affair. That in fact a much larger immigration was of West Africans who came in from northern Nigeria and there, who had been coming in since the 11th century and who in South Darfur, the Falata, they are known as the Falata, in South Darfur they are an Arab tribe, they are West Africans. But actually the migration was very tiny. That in fact most of the Arabs have a different history. Not a single history, but several different histories. So that if you look at the 16th and the 17th century, you will find, not simply in Sudan, but in the entire region, the royalty from Ethiopia onwards beginning to claim descent from the Holy Land. From the Ethiopian kings who claimed descent from King Solomon, to the kings of the Muslim dynasties who claimed descent from the Holy Prophet. That in the 18th century there is the birth of a mercantile civilization in the kingdom of Sinar, for example, where the number of towns grow from 2 to 30 and an entire merchant class develops and new conflicts develop in the marketplace and there is a conflict between the merchants and the royalty over what rules would be used to solve these conflicts. The royalty says custom, the merchants say no, Sharia. Why Sharia? Because Sharia coming out of the Byzantine period is particularly commerce friendly. The merchants win out, they place regents around the king and they proclaim a cosmopolitan identity. We are Arabs. They didn't come from anywhere. They were as local as anybody else. Wendy James's writings showed that many of the slaves of these merchants became Arabs.
those Arabs of the Nile Valley came from both the privileged and the underprivileged classes. But whereas in the Nile Valley, Arab was an identity of privilege and power, not the case in Darfur. In Darfur, the Arab tribes of Darfur are the poorest, the least educated, the poorest, with the least representation in the state or the marketplace. If Darfur is marginalized in Sudan, the Arabs of Darfur are doubly marginalized. Their exclusion from the peace process is simply the latest exclusion. So, the claim, these were Arabs, was also very convenient to those who had other reasons for excluding them from social and political processes. I think I'm persuaded what you're saying, that land is not enough of an answer. Actually, there was more to it, and that more is there in the book. And let me just say what I think was the more, because what I think you got put your finger on is there's an important political dimension to this. And the political dimension begins because Darfur, you know, one of the best historian anthropologists of Darfur, I think, is Sharif Harir, a Darfuri anthropologist. And Sharif Harir, in his writing, at one point speaks of 1980, the time, for the first time, a Darfuri governor is appointed. He speaks of it as the decolonization of Darfur. And if you look at the period from 1980, the governor is a Fur. His deputy is a Zaghawa. The executive splits into two. Around the governor, around the deputy, the Fur is a settled peasant community. Zaghawa is a pastoralist community. And it becomes a confrontation between peasants and pastoralists. There's contention, which goes on. When the Civil War comes, in 87-89, Sharif Harir goes to the Reconciliation Conference in 89, and he documents the speeches on both sides, the representatives on both sides, who are primary school teachers. And what is interesting about his documentation is that each side claims to be a victim in the Civil War. One side in the Civil War claims that it is the target of genocide. In fact, the word they use is Holocaust. I was struck by this. Holocaust, that's the word they use. The other side claims that it is the target of ethnic cleansing being carried out by those tribes which consider themselves native tribes of Darfur and have branded them as settlers. These are the Arab tribes. And this is a far more powerful political, it is no longer simply between nomads and peasants. It is now between natives and settlers, or those alleged, those claiming to be natives, those alleged to be settlers. Because whatever history we know of the pastoralist tribes, the Arab tribes of Darfur, from whatever we know, they've moved around that rim of the Sahara. Settler, I don't know how. The speech, one secretary speaks of the adversaries wanting to expand the Arab belt. On the other side, the secretary says they want to expand the African belt. The first time the use of the word Arab and African comes in. Until then, I didn't see it. It was Arab, non-Arab. 87, 89 is the first time non-Arab becomes African. There's a racializing dynamic. Because one difference between Darfur and Rwanda is that whereas in Rwanda, the racialized historiography has teeth because legislation is racial.
you can't go to school, and you know, Hutu or Tutsi, become a chief or not, Hutu or Tutsi, it's racialized. But in Darfur, the chief is tribal. The land is tribally distributed. The governance is tribal. Whether you can become a chief or not depends on which tribe you come from. So the real discrimination is tribally based. 80s is the first time the racial dynamic begins to come to the surface. My view is that Save Darfur, the international NGOs, the international media feed this dynamic. And to the extent they have fed this dynamic, they've become part of the problem. And that political dimension and that ideological dimension is crucial, because it is actually what took me to, because I became aware, I belonged, for years and years I worked in CODESRIA, Council for Development of Social Research in Africa. I used to be president of CODESRIA for several years. And I noticed that in our debates, the intellectual community was divided by this question of African and Arab. I noticed that the assumption was that the Arabs are settlers from the Middle East. Well, they're not, not in Sudan. And so I really did devote half the book to that question. Something about rule of law? Well, you know, I think I've answered that. I think that cigarette of yours is getting to my head.
Just an ordinary cigarette.
I've given up smoking. I only smoke other people's cigarettes. the oil. The oil, I mean, look, it's no secret. Western powers have controlled Africa's natural resources. Now new powers are on the horizon. They're not coming with the gun. They're coming with trade agreements. They're building infrastructure. Right? They're building dams. Right? Not just in Sudan, in Congo, in Ethiopia, in Nigeria. Right? There's unease here. So the US is neck deep in Chad, in Chadian oil. And China is neck deep in Sudanese oil. What's the problem? I don't see a problem. Problem is what they're willing to do. So long as they don't do this with the gun, it's preferable to the gun, I think. I have no problem. But I don't think the oil explains this conflict. That's really what I think the explanations lie. First of all, the contention over natural resources is Africa-wide. It's not just in Darfur. In some places, it has acted as oil over a fire, but the fire has to be there. Right? There has to be a local issue, which is simmering, for the conflagration to happen. The oil can't create that issue. What I've been trying to point out is that this thing began as a civil war inside Darfur. That question, the land question, will remain. The question of Arab tribes and non-Arab tribes, the question of who is an African, big question. Who is an African? Who is an Arab? Who is an African? All these questions, not just in Sudan, but other places, it will remain. Who is British? I mean, you know, 40 years ago you couldn't speak of black British, could you? You couldn't speak of black British 50 years ago. They would have laughed at you. Now, they say black British are the problem. So you're black British already. So, I think that's it. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Mahmoud on your behalf, and as he's indicated several times, of course this book gives him the space to explore much more deeply some of the
specific questions about the Darfur, historical questions and so on that you've asked, and I'm sure that Mahmoud will agree that you've been a very attentive and inquiring and challenging audience. Thank you. The book is available outside, I believe, for a handsome discount.